Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be talking with Josh Weil, whose splendid new novel is The Great Glass Sea, and Sean Wilsey, who has followed up his wonderful memoir, Oh, the Glory of It All, with a wildly entertaining essay collection, More Curious. Josh Weil's first book, a collection of novellas called The New Valley, marked him as a writer to watch. He received the Sue Kaufman Prize for First Fiction for that book, and that sense of arrival is only confirmed by his marvelous new novel, The Great Glass Sea, set in Russia, where Josh spent a student exchange year in 1991. These two works of fiction are wildly different and worlds apart. Josh Weil, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Now, The Great Glass Sea is such a wonderful combination of things. It's a novel of the dystopian future with overlays of folk and fairy tales. So how did your experience as a young student evolve into this long and complicated novel?
The novel actually was supposed to be a short story at first, so that's the first thing I'd say. It wasn't meant to be long and complicated. It took on a life of its own. But, you know, I went from being a kid having a mind-blowing experience, being in the Soviet Union. Last year was the Soviet Union, and a world that was so different from my own. And that just got very deep inside me, living there. And so I always knew that I wanted to write about it. It had tapped into a part of me that I was already interested in because my mother's family is from Russia. So I had this vague interest. But then when I went there and studied Russian for 6 years throughout high school, it became something that was important in shaping my life when I was a kid turning into an adult. But I never really found a way into writing about it. And then, lo and behold, I'm listening to NPR in Virginia in this little cabin where I spent a lot of time. And it was just a local NPR show, and they're interviewing a professor at Virginia Tech who had written a book on nighttime. And he had a throwaway kind of one-line comment about how the Russians had sent up these satellites that would carry light down onto the Earth as an experiment in the hopes of being able to light a far northern city 24/7. And I thought, first of all, that's absolutely insane. Secondly, it's something that only the Soviet-inspired Russians could do, because it harkens back to a lot of these amazing projects that the Soviets tried to do, like changing the directions of the flow of rivers and things like that. And third, I thought, my God, I just grabbed my imagination, and I had to do something with that. So I started a story collection that was built around, and I wrote a few stories around that idea. And eventually I knew it would take me back to Russia, because that's where this had taken place. And it became just my way into tapping into what all of that stuff that's been roiling inside me since I've been a boy. And I think that's part of why it became the book that it became, as opposed to just a short story. While I thought that I was going through this kind of very narrow and specific angle into it, what it tapped into was so much of what is inside me that I had to deal with it in something a lot longer than a story.
And what a wonderful metaphor for your own writing life, you know, shining a light 24/7.
That's
I love
true.
That.
It's true. It's draining for the people who work there, and sometimes it's draining as a writer, too, to be shining that light all the time. But I think that if you're taken with that life, it also is it's the most incredible thing to be able to do with your life.
Oh, yeah. Now, we should say this is a story of two brothers who grow up on a farm together and then go to work for the Orangeria, a farming effort which is powered by those space mirrors you mentioned. And one of those brothers achieves great success within the bureaucracy of that effort, and the other one doesn't. So I'm curious to know which of these brothers was more appealing to you to write about.
That's interesting. At first, it was definitely the one who doesn't achieve success. I don't know whether it's because I haven't achieved huge success in my life. I don't think that's it. I think it's mostly that brother, his love for his brother was so strong that it pushed him away from other things in life. And I could relate to that. I feel that way about my brother. And luckily, my brother also feels, I think, equally strongly about me. But it was that great need to be with his brother at the expense of of everything else that I was very interested in writing about because I'd gone through periods in my life where I felt that way. That said, there are bits of both brothers in me. Certainly the drive that Yarick feels, the older brother, I think comes from me also. But the first draft of the novel actually was entirely in the younger brother's point of view. And so I definitely attached to him first. The interesting thing for me, and perhaps one of the most rewarding things and important things about writing the novel for me, is that then I felt I had to dip into the older brother's perspective as well. And that became almost an equal part of the book. And that also allowed me to try to see the world through not my brother's eyes, because he's not Yarick, but through the eyes of someone who was dealing with some of the same pressures and expectations that my brother was dealing with, and understand my relationship with my own brother better because of that.
Well, you know, they say in any relationship, there's always one who loves more, you know. And so Dima is such an appealing character because that steady, burning love, it just kind of carries you through his portion of the novel. But then the brother's pressures, and it can be a burden, that love.
Absolutely.
I found them both very moving and interesting.
Oh, that's good. I worried at times that Dima would be, it would be hard to relate to him because he's so swept up in his love for his brother. But I'm hopeful, and it sounds like this worked for you, that people who are swept up in love for anybody in their life will be able to kind of feel the same thing.
Now, one of the brothers, Yarick, goes off and establishes his own family, and Dima lives in an apartment with their mother and cares for her as much as he is able. And one of the things that fascinates me about your work, and this is in the New Valley as well, it's the way domestic life can just completely break down and go to hell. You know, I mean, it's just how squalor just kind of moves in and takes over. And even the mother's sewing, which would ordinarily be something useful and good, turns into something useless and crazy.
Right.
I mean, that's a real gift. I mean, that was in the New Valley as well.
It's so interesting to hear you say that. I don't know that I've thought about it, honestly. But I think you're absolutely right hearing it now. And part of it may be that for a long, long time, I didn't have much of my own domestic life. I lived on my own in this cabin in the middle of nowhere, or in New York City, subletting apartments and living on my own in a little box, and kind of back and forth, or I was visiting writer gigs from kind of one job to the next to the next. And my focus was very kind of obsessive focus on my writing and on my friends that were outside of my home life. But my home life almost felt like it was something that wasn't vital to me. And so I think a lot of what happens with my characters is that there are other things in their life that break down that home life because they're focused elsewhere. That may have root in my own experience. It'll be interesting to see what I write next, because now I'm married. I have a stepdaughter and I've got a son on the way. And I've got a wonderful home life, so I wonder if the next thing I'll write will somehow depart from that. Just from a craft point of view, if a character is going to wrestle with some great wound or some great fear or something that is terrifying to that character or something that they need desperately, which is where I approach all of my writing from that point of view, if the character is going to wrestle with that, then of necessity, the smaller things need to give way under the weight of that. Whether it's just home life or other small things, but things that can break down and give way are going to break down because the pressure is so great on the character about the greater thing.
Well, this is, of course, a novel about the one and the many, about the power and difficulty of individual choice. And one of the essential qualities you're asking throughout this novel is, what do you want? And I love the way that comes out quite baldly in Yarick's life when he kind of makes that alliance with his superior.
Yeah.
And it's kind of what's denied to Dima in a way, don't you think?
Yeah, Dima knows what he wants. He just doesn't have a route to get it. It's not within his power. I mean, he wants to kind of go back to a simple life where he clears the clutter of everything but his brother and his love for his brother away, and they live on a farm together. And live the way they did at a point in life where economically they were destitute, but emotionally and in kind of the experience of living, they were quite rich. And so he's eager to go back to that, but he doesn't have a path to it. He's trying to find a path to it, and he needs Yarick to give him that path. And Yarick has other pressures, like you say. He's constantly wrestling with this idea of what do I want. As much as he loves his brother, he wants other things too. He wants a good life for his family. He wants enough money to give them a good life. Those kinds of things. And I think that although this is set in an alternative Russia, I think that those pressures are ones that most Americans can relate to. And it was a big part of why why I wanted to write this book, was to deal with the kinds of pressures that, especially now, as opposed to, say, in the 50s and the 60s, Americans are dealing with.
Oh, absolutely. That pressure to work 24/7. Substitute the internet for the space mirror, and there you go.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, I hadn't thought of the internet in that way, but boy, there's no question that it puts the same exact kind of pressures to constantly be productive, constantly be doing stuff in our lives, and that is one of the dominant features of life today.
Sad, I think.
I think so, too.
Now, when you were writing this book, did you immerse yourself in Russian literature as well? I know Pushkin is so important.
Yeah, Pushkin is very important. So I immersed myself in particular pieces of literature that I knew were going to be important for this book. So Pushkin's Ruslan and Ludmila, I knew was going to be woven into the fabric of the novel. So, of course, I read that and I thought about that a lot. And that was a big part of my life while I was writing this. A few other things inspired by Russian literature, but at an event I did, someone asked me, did I think of this as a Russian novel or an American novel? And I said, absolutely an American novel, because I'm an American writer. And so I think that the influences here are more about the novels I love that are American novels than Russian novels. That said, there are aspects of Russia and fables and my kind of fabled imagination about Russia that affected this book and that spring in some ways from some Russian novels, from things like Anna Karenina, which I had read parts of, not the whole thing, when I wrote this, but the way that characters and storylines are interwoven and the kind of richness of that. Or certainly Fathers and Sons by Turgenev. I read that while I was traveling doing research in Russia for this book, and that had a big effect on me and the way that ideas are brought to the fore by characters, that kind of thing.
Now, one of the most appealing things about this book as an object is that you have illustrated it yourself with these gorgeous, delicate line drawings.
Oh, thank you.
I love them. I love the end papers, particularly.
The end papers took me about 26 hours straight with a six-hour break to sleep because I was under deadline.
Wow. So did that add some dimension to the bookmaking process for you?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely added dimension to the bookmaking process. I hope it also adds a dimension to the reading experience. And so I wouldn't have done it if I didn't feel it was, in a way, necessary for this novel. I spent about 2 months pretty solid doing illustrations. They're fairly intricate pen and ink illustrations. And the reason I did that is I knew that this story was influenced by fables, even as much as it is by the actual Russia today, even though I did do a lot of research into the actual Russia today. Kind of fables in Russian lore were very, very important to this, and to my sense of Russia ever since I've been a kid there. And for me, those fables are intrinsically linked to the illustrations by Ivan Bilibin, who was a master illustrator working around the turn of the 20th century. And so I wanted to try to place the reader as efficiently and quickly and fully in that sense of the world, that kind of fable-like sense of the world, right from the start. And it felt to me like if I could somehow channel even a sliver of what Bilibin could do into this book, it would do that for the reader. And I hope it does. So that was my main reason for wanting to use illustrations here. For me, what it did is it attached me in a whole nother way to the book and made it just feel like an even more personal project. Obviously, anyone writing a novel, if it's a novel of any worth, it's going to be a very personal project. But this was kind of an entirely another angle, another way that it made it personal for me.
Well, I love them. I'd be so happy when I got to a new chapter because there would be this gorgeous, new thing to look at. So.
I'd love to hear that. I was hoping that would be the way it would feel.
It was wonderful. So thank you so much. We've been talking with Josh Weil, whose new novel is The Great Glass Sea. You can meet him Tuesday, July 22nd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Thank you so much, Josh.
Thank you very much. It's great.
Shad Wilsey is the best-selling author of the memoir, Oh, the Glory of It All, a former editor-at-large for McSweeney's Quarterly Concern, and he's been on the staff of The New Yorker magazine. Today, we're talking with him about his new essay collection, More Curious. Sean, welcome to The Reading Life.
Hey, thank you very much.
Now, this is such a wide-ranging essay collection, and it spans a good bit of time in your life. So when you were putting it together, did you think, Whoa, you know, I've really covered some territory lately.
Yes, I guess I did think that. I mean, in a funny way, the book starts in 98 and comes up to this year. And I feel like a lot has changed in the country, certainly a lot has changed in my life in that period of time. And these essays really kind of track those changes, both for me personally, and just I feel like we're living in a completely different world than we were in 98.
Absolutely. And you also track so many of your obsessions, some of which I share, which is quite wonderful.
I have so many.
No, you do. There's got to be something for everyone. Now, a road trip is a big, big part of this book. A road trip in a slow-moving 1960s Chevy Apache truck with your friend, the architect Michael Meredith, and your dog, Charlie.
Louisiana State dog.
I know. It was a Catahoula.
Well, actually, Catahoulas are a huge obsession of mine. And I guess one of my favorite interviews that's in the book and that's in that piece you're talking about is with this man, Don Abney, who is a Catahoula breeder in Louisiana. And just everything that came out of his mouth was so wise and surprising and funny. The Catahoula has this weird reputation. It's actually not an officially recognized breed, which I find irritating because it's such a cool dog and it's clearly a very distinctive dog like no other. So why not actually acknowledge it? But I don't really know how the whole eugenics of the American Kennel Club works.
Well, it seemed like Charlie was a fairly good traveling companion.
No, he was always pushing me. He was trying to actually like evict me, but he wanted to drive. It was slightly dangerous. He was really convinced that he would be a better driver than I would be.
Now, the road trip is an important part of this book, but the larger journey that it kind of represents is kind of your first visit to Marfa and then leaving and then coming back. And you write a lot about the Republic of Marfa. So tell us a little bit about this place and why it captivated you and drew you in the first place.
Well, you know, it's funny. Marfa has become kind of a very fashionable place, but it is always going to be protected by the fact that it's so hard to get to. And it is, in many ways, more in Mexico than it is in the U.S. It's surrounded on three sides by Mexico. It's just in this little dip of the Big Bend here in West Texas. And I first came out here because my wife, who was then my girlfriend, had a job working for the newspaper here. And she and I had met in New York and dated in New York. And then she announced that she intended to leave New York for the summer and work as a reporter for the paper here. So I went out and visited her. I didn't think it was ugly, but it was just almost terrifying, the landscape here. I mean, there's nothing here. The Spanish word for this area is El Despoblado, the unpopulated place. And you get here and you really are confronted by your own insignificance really immediately. And the landscape is really dramatic, but it's really dry. My idea of beauty in the landscape had been Tuscany prior to being here, and this ain't Tuscany. So it just took me a long time to adjust, but I think I like that experience of being a little bit off kilter and a little bit like discomforted by what's going on around me. And it forced me to kind of go out and start looking for stuff here, because I think in a big city, I'd lived in New York for many years before coming here, you are maybe a little bit on the defensive. And here, you're, although overwhelmed by the landscape, kind of opened up to the very few people that you ever encounter. And you get into these conversations, and you have these experiences with people here that are kind of vivid and strange. And I found myself just meeting people and getting really curious about what this place is. And it kept drawing me back. There are a lot of stories here. My first piece of serious writing was about Marfa, or the serious writing that got published, and that was in McSweeney's. And it was centered around the fact that a lot of the time, there's a major museum here in Marfa that was started by Donald Judd, the minimalist artist in the 1970s, who came here as a sort of refugee from the New York art world and bought an entire military base that had been decommissioned. It was a former cavalry base, and turned it into this uncompromising display base for his work and the work of really his friends and the artists that he most respected, those being John Chamberlain, who worked a lot with Smash Cars, and Klaus Oldenburg and Dan Flavin, who works with light. So because of that, even though it's very remote, people come here to see the place and to experience this work as it was intended to be installed. So this symposium took place here in the late 90s, And my piece was centered around this symposium when Frank Gehry came here, Herzog and Jim Aron, the architects who've gone on to do the Tate Gallery and the Young Museum in San Francisco. And Oldenburg came, some critics came. And because of this, there were 800 people who came to town for the weekend to hear this symposium, which represented, I guess the equivalent would be if 3 million ranchers arrived in New York for a weekend. And I just wanted to see what it would be like to have a town change so dramatically so quickly. And that kind of provided a context to write about what this place was.
And now, what do you find there that's so conducive to the family life you have, the writing life? You're in a different situation in your life now.
Oh, you know, it's very inexpensive here. That's certainly conducive. I mean, goodness, it's just so cheap in Texas compared to any other urban place. And it's very beautiful. It's funny. I lived in New York for a long time, and I mean, this is a little bit of a cliche to say, but just looking at New York and going, man, it's just been totally ruined. Every single corner is a bank. Everyone that can afford to live here just has to work so hard that there's nothing else to do except for work. And there's a lot of slack in Marfa. There's a lot of people kind of hanging around. There's a lot of kind of freaks in Marfa. I guess it's not unlike New Orleans in some way. There's just space here to kind of do your thing. And that's interesting. This is very Marfa. There's a really good bookstore here, and I picked up a copy of this interview with Marcel Duchamp, who spoke to Calvin Tompkins, who I guess is still the art critic at the New Yorker. And it's a really great conversation. It's a short book, just them talking. And Duchamp talks about how, as far as he's concerned, the most important thing in an artist's life is just time to do nothing, to kind of slack off. And Marfa is a good place for that. And you end up driving around and talking to people and coming up with ideas. I mean, I guess obviously it's a good place to just sit at your desk and do some work. But there's a kind of freedom here that I think is important for getting anything done writing-wise.
With Matt Weiland, you did that wonderful anthology, State by State, A Panoramic Portrait of America. And after that, you said that Texas is actually where you feel most at home now.
Yeah, I like Texas. I guess the thing about Texas that I like is it's not trying to fool you. It's not trying to pull the wool over your eyes. It's a little insular. It's a little full of itself. It doesn't really care what anybody else thinks of it. It's kind of got its own politics and its own style. It's really broadly misunderstood outside of Texas to be this conservative, gun-waving kind of place, which to a degree it is. But I don't know. I guess I always feel surprised in Texas, and I'm fairly comfortable with being uncomfortable, which is what Texas is all about. Texas is not trying to make your life easy, that's for sure.
Now, your next book is another memoir, and it's about a rather unusual experience of yours. Tell us about that a bit.
I was an apprentice gondolier in Venice, Italy, in my early 20s. And I worked for a gondolier named Gino Macropodio, which actually, that name means big foot. And I'm still really close to Gino. We talk on the phone practically every day. And he offered me his gondola after my apprenticeship, but I decided that I wanted to try to become a writer instead of a gondolier. And it's probably easier to be a writer than a gondolier anyway. A lot of the book that I'm working on now is about our relationship and the fact that 4 years ago, I went back to Venice and got a slightly smaller boat than a gondola called a sandolo. Venetian boats are all rowed standing up and from the rear, with an oar that's not even in a proper oarlock. It just sits in this little groove. So you've got to have this whole rowing style that's adapted to keeping it from popping out, which if you're an amateur like I was for a long time, it will pop out all the time and really frustrate you. And I got a little boat, a gondola, and I rowed it around the Venetian Lagoon, which is about 212 square miles and full of abandoned islands that used to be an integral part of Venice when Venice was a real deal city instead of essentially a tourist place now. And I camped out on all these islands. A lot, most of them were abandoned, but some of them were still being used by monks or farmers, or in one case, there's a cat sanctuary. And I just had this crazy kind of, it was a little bit like a Huck Finn adventure in the Venetian Lagoon. And so that's a big part of this book, which is also a memoir about living in Italy, where I lived for 4 years, working as a waiter, working in museums, and kind of growing up there.
Well, I can't wait. You've led such an interesting life. I almost can't wait to see what happens next.
Oh, gosh, thanks.
And I would also like to say that my favorite essay, oddly, in this book was called Some of Them Can Read. And it's about
about
rats, which was just
rats, man.
That was one of the most dazzling essays, I have to tell you.
Aren't they just so impressive? It's funny. I was actually writing a little bit about rats this morning. I wanted to get a regular rat column for the London Review of Books where that essay appeared, but they didn't go for it. So sadly, I just have to keep all my rat thoughts to myself. But I was literally thinking about the fact that Marfa is, there are a lot of rats out here in the West. A lot of them carry the bubonic plague, fascinatingly enough. But I think that the moment that a town becomes a city is the moment that rats really decide to make their presence felt there. I think that's how it works. You're a little town, you don't really have a rat problem. Once you're a city, you know you're a real deal city when you've got rats.
I know. They're endlessly fascinating, I think. So.
They are.
They really are.
I have so much respect for
that. Well, I'll ask you about that when you're here, too. We've been talking with Sean Wilsey, whose most recent book is the fabulous essay collection, More Curious. You can meet him Wednesday, July 23rd at 6 at Octavia Books. Sean, thank you so much.
Hey, thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Today's guest, Josh Weil, discusses and signs The Great Glass Sea, Tuesday, July 22nd at 6 at the Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, Sean Wilsey, discusses and signs More Curious, Wednesday, July 23rd at 6 at Octavia Books. Lynette Tanner discusses and signs Chained to the Land, Voices from Cotton and Cane Plantations, Wednesday, July 24th at 6 at Octavia Books. R.S. Broadhead signs Unveiled, and P.L. Jones signs Bound, Saturday, July 26th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. John E. Wade signs Glimpses of Heaven on Earth, Sunday, July 27th at 2 at Garden District Bookshop. There will be an open mic reading Sunday, July 27th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Don't forget, the hunt for Where's Waldo is still on through 24 Uptown area businesses. Get your passport for Octavia Books, set out on your hunt for the popular children's book character, and plan to attend the Waldo Party July 31st at 5 at Octavia Books. Also coming up in August, the Authors and Readers Convention takes place August 14th through 17th at the Marriott on Canal Street. Featured authors include Heather Graham and A.L. Jackson, along with dozens more. Events include a haunted history ghost tour, a Florida Diva party at Trashy Diva, and a masquerade costume ball. Check out authorreadercon.com for more information or to register. And Heather Graham's Writers for New Orleans takes place August 29th through 31st at the Hotel Monteleone. If you're an aspiring writer, especially of genre fiction, this is a good conference for you, with panel discussions and opportunities to meet editors and agents. Among the authors slated to attend, in addition to Heather Graham, are Julie Smith, Jacqueline Michard, and Chris Mooney. Check out writersforneworleans.com for more information or to register. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.